Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 33, The Baptismal Controversy. Last episode, we looked at events affecting the Eastern churches during the 250s. Today, we head back to the West and look at one of the largest controversies to erupt in the anti-Nicene church. We last left Cyprian and the African church just after the Second Council of Carthage, where the lapsed were readmitted due to fears of a renewed persecution. In Rome, Cornelius had recently died after being exiled by the Emperor Gallus, and was succeeded by the Presbyter Lucius, who had also been exiled by the Emperor. We'll never know if Gallus was indeed planning to renew persecution, because in the summer of 253, another Roman civil war broke out, and Gallus was overthrown. Just as Decius had revolted against Philip and led the Balkan legions to Italy, a general named Aemilianus was proclaimed Augustus by the Moesian legions. When Aemilianus arrived in Italy in August 253, Gallus' legions deserted him and joined the usurper. It wasn't long before both Gallus and his son were dead, and Aemilianus was the new emperor of Rome. But within a matter of weeks, Gallus' ally arrived with the legions from the Rhine frontier. This time, Aemilianus' troops deserted him and joined his rival. This new emperor was Publius Licinius Valerianus. In less than a couple months, Rome had seen a changeover of imperial dynasties no less than three times. Upon assuming the throne, Valerian appointed his son, Publius Licinius Egnatius Gallienus, as his co-Augustus. A full discussion of these events can be found in episode 111 of Mike Duncan's The History of Rome. As we shall see, both of the new emperors would play important, but markedly different roles in the history of the early church. In September of 253, right around the time Valerian and Gallienus were assuming their joint rule of the empire, Cyprian was presiding over what was now the Third Council of Carthage. This council, consisting of 66 bishops, was called in response to issues raised by a bishop named Fidus. The location of his see is unknown, though presumably somewhere in Africa Proconsularis. The first issue concerned the actions of another bishop, Therapius of Bula, who had readmitted his lapsed presbyter Victor into communion before Victor had completed his period of penance, as prescribed by the earlier councils of Carthage. After a lengthy discussion, Cyprian and the 66 bishops agreed that, with Fidus, that Therapius had done something wrong, and they reprimanded him for this action. Nevertheless, Victor's restoration was still to be accepted. Therapius was a bishop of God, and once a bishop had granted reconciliation, it should not be taken away. The second issue raised concerned the baptism of infants. Fidus believed that just as male Israelite infants were not circumcised until after the eighth day, Christian infants should also not be baptized until after the eighth day. Baptism being the initiation ritual into the new covenant, just as circumcision had for the old. Fidus also argued that infants were unclean after birth, both physically and spiritually, and thus the time of purification was needed before the sacrament of baptism could be administered. But Cyprian and the council came to the unanimous conclusion that Fidus was wrong. God made no distinctions between people, regardless of age. All persons should be able to access baptism and grace. The eighth day had been a sign in the Old Covenant which prefigured the Lord's Day after the Sabbath. Thus, it had no bearing on church practice now. Infants were even more eligible for baptism because they had committed no sin that needed washing away. They only inherited the disease of death, and the only sin which needed to be washed away was Adam's. This is interesting because it is the first documentable instance of something resembling the later doctrine of original sin. Original sin, the doctrine that all humans inherit Adam's sinful guilt, will eventually become a cornerstone of Western soteriology. Cyprian, of course, does not develop this idea into a fully fleshed out system, but it is interesting to note that he makes these statements without any indication that it is a novel idea. Cyprian dealt with many other issues during these years, including his continued conflict with the Novatians, Laxus, and even securing the release of Christians taken captive by Moorish raiders. He was still being plagued with the charge of cowardice by his enemies for having hid during the Decian persecution, a charge that would still be leveled even after his death. But for now, the controversies had largely been settled, and Cyprian was as secure as ever in his role as archpastor of Carthage and member of the Universal College of Bishops. He never would have guessed that in no short amount of time he would find himself in open conflict with his brother bishop in Rome. On March 5th, 254 AD, Lucius of Rome died. After an interval of just over 2 months, Lucius's archdeacon Stephen was consecrated on May 12th as the new Bishop of Rome. Tensions between Rome and Carthage began almost immediately. The first contention between Stephen and Cyprian was related to the Novatian Schism. Here, the Church of Gaul comes back into the historical record. We have not visited Gaul since discussing Irenaeus back in episode 18. A successor to Irenaeus' See of Lugdunum, Faustinus, had repeatedly sent letters to Stephen, as had other Gallic bishops. They begged Stephen to intervene and help depose the bishop of Arles, Marcianus. Marcianus had joined the Novatians and instituted a harsh policy towards the Lapps, denying them penance and a way back to the church. This was gross pastoral malpractice, but for whatever reason, Stephen had thus far made no effort to aid the Gallic church in ousting Marcianus and electing a successor. So Faustinus wrote to Cyprian, explaining the situation and asking him to move on Stephen to intervene. Cyprian was outraged at the cruelty of Marcianus's lapsed policy. It was an affront to the entire College of Bishops that such a man could continue in his damaging leadership over the church. On top of all this, Marcianus had allied himself with Novatian, the enemy of God's people. He was therefore no longer a true bishop in the Catholic faith, and therefore any bishop in communion with him was invariably tainted. All these points are emphasized in Cyprian's own letter to Stephen, where he exhorted the Bishop of Rome to do what was right and help the Christians of Gaul. Cyprian's letter to Stephen, with its impassioned tone, is a stunning example of how far Cyprian had come as a compassionate pastor since his earlier, more rigorous days during the Decian persecution. Stephen's response to Cyprian's letter is unknown. But since we hear no further mention of the controversy over Marcianus, it may be inferred that Stephen was finally moved to act and a new bishop was elected for the Church of Arles. But why did Stephen not intervene earlier? Possibly because he was still insecure in his see. The Marcianus controversy occurred in May of 254, so almost immediately after Stephen became bishop. Novatian was still leading his rival Church of Rome right down the street, as it were. But on the other hand, Novatian's movement had been clearly condemned, and it's hard to see how Marcianus constituted any real threat to Stephen's position. So, in the end, we simply don't know why Stephen was so reluctant to act. The second conflict between Stephen and Cyprian occurred at this time. But whereas the Marcianus of Arles controversy involved Novatianism, this controversy involved the lapsed. Here again, another Christian community pops into the historical record. Two Spanish bishops, Basilides of Legio Astorica, modern-day Astorga, and Martialis of Emerita Augusta, modern-day Merida, had lapsed during the Decian persecution by acquiring Libelli. These disgraced bishops had even gone further in their apostasy. While on his sickbed, he recovered, Basilides invoked the pagan gods. Marcialis had joined pagan clubs and banquets, buried his sons in a pagan manner, and actually sacrificed before the magistrates and denounced Christ during the Decian persecution. These men were clearly compromised. They could, through penitence, eventually return to the church, but only as laymen. The Spanish Christians duly elected successors to Basilides and Marcialis, whose names were Sabinus and Felix, respectively. But the apostate bishops desired to be reinstated to their sees, and so Basilides pleaded their case to Stephen. The Bishop of Rome, shockingly, sided with the apostate bishops against the Christians of Spain. Clearly taken aback by Stephen's decision, Felix and Sabinus knew they needed the support of a see which rivaled that of Rome. Cyprian and his peers received the Spanish pleas and discussed the issue at the Fourth Council of Carthage in late May of 254, which consisted of 37 bishops. The council easily decided in favor of Felix and Sabinus against their apostate rivals and Stephen's decision. Cyprian and the council issued a letter to the Spanish churches, encouraging them and laying out arguments to support their mutual views. Basilides and Marcialis had committed the most serious of sins, apostasy. Readmittance was only possible as laymen. Cyprian cited passages from Exodus and Leviticus to confirm his view that priests of God must be without blemish to serve at his altar. Anyone in communion with these apostate, idol-worshipping bishops risked contaminating his or herself. Cyprian could only explain Stephen's decision by assuming that Basilides had simply hoodwinked and deceived the Bishop of Rome into making such an obvious error in judgment. As for Stephen himself, once again, we do not know what his response was to Cyprian. Again, it's possible that since our sources make no further mention of this controversy, Stephen may have relented and dropped the matter. Cyprian had shown himself to be a strong ally of the bishops of Rome. He eventually supported Cornelius against Novatian, corresponding with him and his successor Lucius. But within a month, his relations with the newly consecrated Stephen had gotten off to an extremely rocky start. And what about Stephen? It seemed that within just a matter of weeks of his consecration, the new bishop of Rome had shown himself to be borderline incompetent when it came to dealing with ecclesiastical business. Marcianus of Arles should have been deposed right away, and Basilides and Marcialis were clearly apostates with no rightful claim to their sees. Such a series of events reveals Stephen to have been a poor handler of church affairs. Or does it? It's important to keep in mind that we do not have sources from all sides of these two conflicts. We don't have replies from Stephen to Cyprian, or to the bishops in Gaul, Spain, or Africa. We don't have any writings from Marcianus of Arles or Basilides and Marcialis explaining their viewpoints. There is even evidence in Cyprian's letter to the Spanish churches that Basilides and Marcialis had supporters in Spain. As such, our sources are entirely one-sided and come exclusively from two letters by Cyprian. While Cyprian's letters are quite detailed, we need to keep in mind that we don't have the other side of the story. Perhaps underwriting all this were the diverging ecclesiologies of Cyprian and Stephen. To sum up Cyprian's ecclesiology again, the Catholic Church was mother to the children of God. She had clear-cut boundaries. You were either in or out. For only in the Catholic Church was the Holy Spirit active. No grace existed outside the Church. And the bishop, by virtue of his apostolic succession, was the prime vehicle through which the means of grace were distributed. The leadership of the church was a tightly bound college of bishops, each answerable to God alone and sovereign in their respective regions. All clergy, especially bishops, needed to be above suspicion when it came to morality and heresy, and all bishops needed to recognize one another. Finally, a true Catholic bishop could not be in communion with any schismatic or heretic without being tainted and infected himself. Stephen would no doubt have agreed with many aspects of Cyprian's ecclesiology. Yet crucially, he did not share Cyprian's belief that grace only existed in the church. Stephen did not think of the church in the same stark black and white terms Cyprian did, with the church being Noah's Ark and a person was either in it or not. The Holy Spirit was active outside the visible bounds of the Catholic Communion, and schismatics and heretics could have access to divine grace. Such a fundamental disagreement over the means of grace within the Christian Church lay at the heart of the difference between Stephen and Cyprian's ecclesiologies. The third and final controversy between the bishops of Rome and Carthage began in the spring of 255. A synod of 18 Numidian bishops wrote to Cyprian and the bishops of Proconsularis about how to receive converts from schismatic and heretical groups. The leader of these Numidian bishops was Januarius of Lambesis. His predecessor was the disgraced Privatus, who, if you'll remember, became a leader of the Laxus Church. As such, Januarius and his colleagues were combating the Laxus directly, and were now bringing many who had joined the Laxus back into the Catholic fold. But just how should they be received? The Laxus were schismatics, not heretics, and so they shared the church's faith. Was schismatic baptism valid? Was even heretical baptism valid under certain conditions? Decades ago, Cyprian's predecessor, Agrippinus, had held a council which answered no, and instituted the practice of rebaptizing anyone who joined the church from heretical and schismatic groups. Of course, rebaptism is not how its proponents saw it. Rather, heretical and schismatic baptism was considered invalid because it was outside the bounds of the Catholic Church. The Numidian bishops agreed with the decisions of Agrippinus' council, but nonetheless had been forced by the circumstances to reconsider the matter. Cyprian and 31 proconsular bishops gathered at the Fifth Council of Carthage to respond to Januarius' letter. The proconsular bishops agreed that heretics and schismatics needed to be rebaptized. No sacrament or altar or cleric was valid outside the Catholic Church. Finally, clergy from other sects had to be received as laymen. These decisions were in line with what had been the African Church's views for decades now. But there was another custom, which predated the Council of Agrippinus. This tradition allowed for heretical, and certainly schismatic, baptism to be valid, and converts from these sects were only to be received by the laying on of hands, i.e., the sacrament of confirmation. Among the adherents of this older tradition was, you guessed it, Stephen of Rome. As far back as anyone could remember, the practice in Rome for receiving non-Orthodox Christians was the laying on of hands, not baptism, for baptism was a one-time event. So long as they were baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, a person's baptism was valid. The sacrament of baptism was done only once, and if done in the correct form, regardless of the faith of the baptizer or baptizee, had the power to wash away sin. All that was needed for the Catholic bishop or presbyter to perform was the sacrament of confirmation, so the convert would receive the Holy Spirit. In reaffirming his adherence to the old Roman tradition, Stephen was probably trying to ease reconciliation with repentant novatians. Cyprian held another council on the issue. This sixth council of Carthage in the spring of 256 included a grand total of 71 bishops. The council reaffirmed the African position and sent envoys with a copy of the conciliar letter to Rome to inform Stephen of their decision. Cyprian and his colleagues acknowledged the fact that other churches in the Catholic Communion may have other practices, but for their community in North Africa, this was the policy they were following. This letter to Rome was most likely sent as part of a routine way of keeping the churches of Italy informed and connected to the churches of North Africa, just as Cornelius had received a letter from the Second Council of Carthage 4 years earlier. It also reflects Cyprian's concern for the unity of the church based on the consensus of all bishops. Cyprian probably figured that the issue of heretical baptism had been settled, but he could not have been more wrong. First, Cyprian received a letter of inquiry from Quintus, a bishop in Mauritania, essentially asking the same questions Januarius had. But crucially, Quintus mentions the existence of the alternative tradition of receiving heretics and schismatics via confirmation. Cyprian responded by reiterating his arguments that no baptism was valid outside the church. In addition, he affirmed that Orthodox Christians who had fallen away and joined with heretics did not need to be baptized again, but simply do penance. As for the tradition of receiving heretics and schismatics with confirmation, Cyprian stated that old custom was inferior to reason. A tradition may be old, but that does not mean it is correct. Reason must trump tradition. He used the example of the dispute over circumcision between Peter and Paul to confirm this point. Cyprian also sent Quintus a copy of the conciliar letter of the Sixth Council of Carthage. Before Stephen's response arrived in Carthage, Cyprian received two more letters of inquiry concerning the baptism of schismatics, specifically the Novatians. The Novatians were, after all, Orthodox in both faith and practice. They had merely broken from the church over the pastoral issue of the lapsed. The authors of these letters, the first, an otherwise unknown clergyman named Magnus, and the second, a presumably Mauritanian bishop named Jubianus, were to a certain extent critical of Cyprian's views, and the Bishop of Carthage became ever more exasperated as he was forced to reiterate again and again that there was no valid baptism outside the church. To add insult to injury, Jubianus pointed out that Cyprian's position was precisely that of the Novatians themselves, who also rebaptized Catholic and heretical converts to their Church of the Pure. Cyprian rejected their arguments that heretical, yet Trinitarian baptism did cleanse a person of their sins, yet did not bestow the Holy Spirit. A person could only be cleansed by the power of the Holy Spirit, and so valid baptism required the initiate to receive the Spirit, and the grace of the Spirit only existed in the Catholic Communion, to be dispensed through the College of Bishops. All these questionings of the African view succeeded to increasingly frustrate Cyprian. But the biggest bombshell was yet to come. The chronology of all this is difficult to discern, but in the late summer or early autumn of 256, the churches of Rome and Carthage ceased to be in communion with one another. Stephen received the conciliar letter of the Sixth Council of Carthage and flatly rejected it. He upheld the old Roman tradition of receiving non-Orthodox converts via confirmation. At some point, envoys from Africa were denied hospitality by Stephen, which had the effect of threatening excommunication with Cyprian. Stephen denounced the Bishop of Carthage as a false Christ, a false apostle, and a deceitful worker. He dispatched his own letter outlining the Roman position, which caused many other bishops in Africa, such as one Pompeius, to query Cyprian over Stephen's arguments. Cyprian, in turn, denounced Stephen and argued vigorously against him. Among the arguments Stephen used to support his position was that he was defending the apostolic tradition, since the Church of Rome had always received non-Orthodox converts by the laying on of hands. Cyprian and the Africans were innovators, deviating from the faith once and for all delivered to the saints. Had not the African practice actually been changed less than a generation earlier by Agrippinus's council? Stephen also pointed out how even heretics receive Christian converts via confirmation, a further testament to the antiquity of the Roman tradition. Another one of the major arguments Stephen used in attempting to enforce the Roman tradition of baptism on the church as a whole was the position of his bishopric. According to Stephen, by virtue of being Bishop of Rome, he was the focal point of church unity. Why was this so? Because he was the successor to Peter, the head apostle, and the rock upon which the church was built, according to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 16. Stephen further appears to have asserted that on this Petrine basis, he was a bishop of bishops. It's quite interesting, and I must say quite surprising, that here we are, over 30 episodes into the podcast, and only now are we finally beginning to talk about the papacy. Now, of course, we've met various bishops of Rome in the course of our story, but up until now, the concept of the papacy, where the Roman bishop has some kind of higher authority than all other bishops, has not yet come up. Before jumping to conclusions, though, Stephen's claims of Roman primacy did not pop out of nowhere. Regardless of one's ecclesiology, the Bishop of Rome was always going to be a particularly important leader in the Christian Church. For one, he was the bishop of the imperial capital, and thus was naturally a focal point. This may seem quite obvious, but remember that the bishops of the major cities of the East, Alexandria and Antioch, were also bishops of greater prominence because of the political position of their sees, i.e. being the second and third cities of the Roman Empire. Second, Rome was where both Peter and Paul had ministered and been martyred under Nero. The sites of their martyrdoms, the Vatican Hill for Peter, and the Appian Way for Paul, were sacred sites, and the presumed relics of the two apostles were venerated in the Church of Rome. Third, Rome was the only apostolic see in the Latin West, whereas in the East there were dozens of churches which could claim an apostle as their founder: James for Jerusalem, Peter for Antioch, Mark for Alexandria, Titus for Crete, Timothy for Ephesus, Dionysius for Athens, and the numerous cities in Anatolia and the Balkans which could point to Paul as their founder. But in the West, there was only Rome. There are stories which place James, the son of Zebedee, in Spain, but these come from legends of later times. Not even Carthage, for all its importance, could claim an apostolic founder. Rather, the Church of Carthage was important because Carthage was the second most important city in the Latin-speaking half of the empire. Finally, we should look back on the role the Roman Church and its leaders have played in our narrative so far. As early as the late 1st century, Clement of Rome was asked to intervene in a dispute in the Church of Corinth across the Adriatic Sea over in Greece. It was the Church of Rome which excommunicated the great heresiarch Marcion. Bishop Soter, in the mid-2nd century, was renowned for his generous use of his church's resources to help other Catholic communities, a fact which was also true of many other early Roman bishops. The Quarto Decimum controversy began when Bishop Victor excommunicated the Asian Christians for celebrating Easter on a different day, something which caused a huge controversy and required the great Irenaeus of Lugdunum to intervene and dissuade Victor from creating a schism. When controversy arose over the Montanus and Origen of Alexandria, support from the Bishop of Rome was highly sought after. In this episode, both the bishops of Gaul and Spain appealed to Stephen to intervene in local affairs. Finally, Cyprian himself, when he first penned his anti-novatian work on the unity of the Catholic Church, spoke of the Bishop of Rome inheriting the primacy of the Apostle Peter. On this point, it's worth elaborating. There are two versions of this crucial passage in chapter 4 of On Unity, which have come down to us in the manuscripts. The shorter version, the primacy text, speaks in favor of the Bishop of Rome having a sort of Petrine primacy. The longer version, the received text, is quite different, and goes to great lengths to assert that all bishops inherit the same Petrine authority. For a long time, a great deal of ink was spilled, and quite frankly, wasted, between Protestant and Roman Catholic scholars over which text was authentic. Protestants wanted to claim that the received text was the original, and that later papist scribes corrupted Cyprian's work. Roman Catholic scholars, in turn, wanted to argue that the primacy text was the authentic original, and thus gave clear evidence to the doctrine of papal primacy in the anti-Nicene Church. Thankfully, modern scholarship on Cyprian is far more concerned with understanding the 3rd century than the 16th. The unanimous consensus today is actually that both versions are authentic. The primacy text is the original, but Cyprian later changed his own book after falling out with Stephen, having now experienced the dangers of assigning primacy to the Roman bishop. All this is to say that, although we are a long way away from the Roman Catholic papacy as we understand it, Stephen's claims did not arise in a vacuum. Cyprian responded to Stephen's various arguments, rejecting Roman primacy and championing the equality of all bishops. Reason trumped old custom or so-called tradition regardless, and Stephen's observation that heretics also receive Christian converts via confirmation was mocked and refuted. But the Bishop of Carthage knew he needed to gain wider support for his position, which he did from the churches of Anatolia. This support included prominent bishops we have already met: Firmilian of Caesarea Eusebia and the Cappadocian bishops, Hellenus of Tarsus and the Cilician bishops, as well as the bishops of Galatia and other neighboring regions. The churches of Anatolia had, like Carthage under Agrippinus, held synods over the issue of heretical baptism not long before, and had come to a common agreement. There were two councils in particular, held in the Phrygian cities of Iconium and Synnada. There it was decided, as it had in Carthage, that baptism was only valid within the church, and heretics and schismatics had no ability to administer the sacrament. The council that met in Iconium is especially interesting in that it was called in response to the specific question of Montanist baptism. The adherents of the old Phrygian heresy were in agreement with the Orthodox concerning the Holy Trinity, and baptized with the same formula. Yet the Council of Iconium determined firmly that their baptism was not valid because it was outside the Catholic Church. For had not the Apostle Paul clearly stated in Ephesians 4:5, "One Lord, one faith, one baptism"? Stephen would have none of it, however, and he even went so far as threatening to break communion with the churches of Asia Minor as well. This got the attention of all the Eastern bishops, who were greatly distressed and outraged by Stephen's threat. Already at this early date, we can see the signs of tension between the Latin West and Greek East. Among the most infuriated Eastern bishops was Firmilian of Caesarea. We have a letter which survives from Firmilian, addressed in response to a now-lost letter of Cyprian. In it, Firmilian concurs with Cyprian's view on heretical baptism, and mocks Stephen's claim to be the Petrine rock upon which the Lord founded the church. He also pointed out how the Quarto Decimane controversy was evidence that Roman tradition was not always so universal. Firmilian also brought up the baptisms performed by the demon-possessed woman after the local persecution circa 234, which we discussed back in episode 26. Would Stephen seriously defend the notion that a baptism performed by a demoniac was valid just because it used the Trinitarian formula? It was around this point that the premier bishop of the East, Dionysius of Alexandria, got involved and wrote to Stephen. Dionysius was quite upset by Stephen's actions, not only because he disagreed with Stephen's views, but especially because the Eastern bishops had just come together in harmony after much division over the issue of Novatianism. Now Stephen was threatening to break this fragile peace. Though normally very meek and peaceful in his tone, Dionysius' letter to Stephen betrays his deep anxiety. Given the normally mild manner of Dionysius, this is quite a testament to the extent of the ire which Stephen caused in the East. Dionysius also wrote letters on the subject of baptism to Stephen's clergy, including two presbyters, an otherwise unknown Philemon, and the other, also named Dionysius. Remember him, because we shall meet Dionysius of Rome again. Before moving on, I should point out that, despite their respectively voluminous correspondences, Cyprian and Dionysius never mention one another, and appear completely unaware of the other's existence. I don't know why this is, and I'm not sure anyone else does either, but for whatever reason, there appears to have been no communication between the Christian leaders of North Africa and Egypt. Back in North Africa, Cyprian and his colleagues gather together for one final council. On September 1st, 256 AD, 87 bishops from Africa Proconsularis, Numidia, and Mauritania came together at Carthage. The letters of Cyprian, Stephen, and others were read aloud. Deliberations were made, and a consensus was reached. Together with one voice, the council affirmed that no baptism was valid outside the Catholic Church, the sole domain of the divine grace of the Holy Spirit. And of course, the council rejected any notion of a bishop of bishops, Roman or otherwise. This Seventh Council of Carthage solidified Cyprian's view of baptism for all the Christian communities of North Africa. There were a few dissenting views still within Africa, as is evidenced by Cyprian's own letters and an anonymous treatise on rebaptism, but nonetheless, the African Christians were united against Rome in their views. Fears of schism were high, something which Cyprian was greatly troubled by given his view on the essentialness of unity between Orthodox bishops. Thus, he did not demand that all other churches adopt his policy, as Stephen had. But fears of schism would quickly disappear. Less than a year later, Stephen would pass away, with much of the controversy dying with him. The question of heretical baptism and rebaptism had not been settled completely, however. It will appear again, only with less controversy. By that time, the church will reach a broad consensus, which mixed Cyprian and Stephen's positions, making a distinction between schismatics and degrees of heresy. The controversy was also halted by another event. Just as Stephen was preparing to fall asleep in the Lord, the Emperor Valerian launched the second empire-wide persecution of Christianity. As always, thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, You can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Please don't forget to leave a review on iTunes, post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.